The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to another night of the fifth annual Philadelphia Book Festival, which is now a sensational 6 days long. My name is Ed Tedemer, and I am a fat and happy member of the George S. Pepper Society here at the Free Library. And I'm here to say welcome, and I'm here to say, why don't you join me in the coolest book club in the city and help support the programming that comes out of this great place. And this is a pretty hip young crowd tonight, so you could help, you know, lower the median age of the organization a little bit. Never a bad thing. And you'll help make possible all the things that come out of the Free Library of amazing, cool stuff. So anybody here see Garrison Keillor on Monday? Wasn't that a great show? He was pretty awesome. And how about the beautiful and beguiling Tina Fey on Tuesday? Anybody here for that? She's, my wife and I have been talking about making one of those lists, you know, and she's on it. So. Anybody been here every day this week? Huh? A few of us besides Andy? Well, I invite you here tomorrow for a full day of family bookishness stuff. We'll be having a teddy bear picnic here tomorrow. A conversation at 11 a.m. with the great Chris Van Allsburg. Who doesn't read Polar Express to their kid on Christmas Eve? I still do. There's a very cool teen zone here tomorrow. Even a tent from the Philadelphia International of the arts for all you funky Francophiles. That'll be happening. And everything's happening rain or shine, which reminds me, rain is a scientific event, and science is happening tomorrow, too, as the Philadelphia Science Festival got started today, and the carnival is tomorrow. So this parkway is going to be happening. So it's going to be a buzz with geeks and nerds and bookworms, and I hope you all come out and bring the family. So now it's time to get out the iPhones and the Droids and the Blackberries and the Guava Jellies and turn them off. But before you do, I'm going to take a little video here for the Facebook. Say hello to everybody. Hi, Facebook. All my 340 friends will see you later. So before you turn off your phone, why don't you text a friend or a family member or somebody out of town and say, yeah, I'm here, and I'm doing something very cool, and then you should turn it off. As we get into a very interesting and entertaining evening here at the Free Library of Tall Tales and Preposterous Pontification. Tonight we bring you the strange and beautiful offspring of a wonderful partnership between the Free Library and our good friends at First Person Arts. I've been honored to host several of the story slams at L'Etage, and I'm here to tell you you're in for a rare treat if you haven't seen one of these yet. Tonight, it's on stage right here. We'll have the best yarn spinners from First Person Arts from our magnificent hometown of Philadelphia. Come on, baby! Champions versus the best bloviators from Beantown, from the New England storytelling organization Mass Mouth, our fair friends from the city of Boston. Who's here from Boston tonight? Let's hear it. A few boos. Well, this is Philly. Listen, bean eaters, you are in our house tonight. And you know folks are going to be rooting for the first-person faves. Don't feel too bad about that. I am no fan of Boston in particular, nor of the Red Sox, but I am here to tell you that there is one cold, hard fact that unites us, and that is our utter disdain, our common utter disdain for the New York Yankees. Am I right? Okay, let's get it on. Your texting, I hope, is done. Your pictures are done of me that I'll be on your Facebook page. And now it is my exquisite pleasure to bring you tonight's host, the one and only Beth Nixon. Give it up for Beth. Thank you.
Hi, Hi, everybody. I'm delighted to be here. And I'm Beth Nixon. I operate Ramshackle Enterprises. I make puppet shows and clown shows and other things out of cardboard. And tonight, it's my great honor to be hosting this incredible gathering of folks from both Boston and Philly. And as a Rhode Islander in my blood, I feel like I'm well-positioned, you know, to be here and offer you a safe space. Although I've lived here for the last 12 years, so. So this is run by First Person Arts, a Philly proud, member-supported nonprofit committed to the power of the personal. And we're celebrating the 10th anniversary this year of First Person Arts. Woo, woo! And so that's a good time to also thank our sponsors, City Paper, Philadelphia Book Festival, and the Free Library of Philadelphia, Philadelphia Science Festival, World Cafe Live, and Lataj, the regular hosts of the regular twice-monthly Story Slams. And upcoming events. First Person Arts presents events each and every month. This next slam is at part of what everyone's been struggling with. Is it PIFA? Is it PIFA?
PIFA.
Is it PIFA?
PIFA.
People say maybe PIFA. I don't know. That's what I was just advised.
I think it's PIFA.
But it's happening at the Kimmel Center where the best story tellers from across story smellers from across the country are sharing their stories at the Kimmel Center, and there's a special discount that I'm going to let you in on, but it's only for people who are at this particular event. So what you want to do is use the discount code LIBRARYSLAM, all one word, all lowercase, to get $10 off your tickets. You can learn more about that event at the PIFA Slam Nation. It's called Slam Nation. I didn't say that. And it's on April 26th, which is also important to note. So Library Slam, all one word, all lowercase. You can learn about that and other events and how you can donate to First Person Arts at firstpersonarts.org. Sorry, I'm reading off of a script. There's a lot of information for someone who just walks up here. So unlike a standard storytelling slam, we have two storytelling teams. Two storytelling teams tonight. We've got the team from Boston. We've got a team from Philly. And the team from Boston, it was selected from a storytelling organization called Mass Mouth in Boston. And the teams from Philly, which is four people from here, four people from there, the Philly team was selected by some of First Person Arts staff. And they're going by the best storytellers in Philly right now as well. So we've got a lot of bests in here. For tonight's slam, we'll have three winners. There's the best city, there's the best storyteller, and there's the audience favorite. That's you guys who get to pick which it is. Who is, of any of these eight people, is the best? And then we'll tell you about how you're making those decisions in a minute. But first, we're going to tell you about our judges and about the theme, which hopefully you know, which is experiments, which is sort of why this is linked also to the Philadelphia Science Festival, which is happening, which I already talked about. We are getting into the judges. After each story, you'll also hear me calling on our official judges, whose scores will determine our winner tonight, the best city, and the best storyteller. And those judges are judge number one. Perhaps you want to stand up or wave or something. No. Yes. Great. And she is Anna DiDio, and she is an all-around woman extraordinaire and Story Slam super fan. Thank you, Anna. And out there, I'm not sure where you are, Amanda. Can you wave your hand? Amanda, you're right there. How easy. I didn't know that was you. So this is Anna Pfeiffer O'Brien, who is the reigning best storyteller in Philadelphia because she won last year's Grand Slam. Hand up for Amanda. And our third judge, which I'm very excited to present, is also doing double duty here as our guest storyteller is going to sort of kick off the storytelling motion of the evening. This person is Mary Roach, who is an acclaimed science writer. So Mary wrote Packing for Mars, which exposes the less known and more quirky aspects of space travel. You can see her again tomorrow in a Philadelphia Science Festival program where she'll be talking with astronomer Derek Pitts. That's 2 p.m. at the Franklin Institute. Mary Roach, we would love to hear your story now before I regale these people with all these rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks a lot. I've been here before, and I really love this place, and I love Philadelphia, so thanks for being Philadelphia. Experiments. Yeah, I wrote this book a while back called Bonk, The Curious Science of... Jill, what's my subject? The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. And so this is a book where I look at people, researchers who study arousal and orgasm, and they bring people into the lab, and they observe them and all of that. And so, of course, I had to find some experiments, and I thought maybe, you know, I could be there in the room while the experiment is going on, and they would say, no, that's really not going to work, but why don't you be a subject? You know, on a couple of occasions, that's what I did. Most notably, the Dr. Deng scenario. Anybody who's read the book, you know what's coming. Dr. Deng is someone that I found by going onto PubMed, and which is a database of all these articles, journal articles, and you know, typing in erectile and penis and penile. And then I found this guy who was... he'd written this paper. He does ultrasound movies, four-dimensional moving pictures, ultrasound being, you know, with the wand on the belly. So, and he'd written this paper about for The Lancet, you know, above board, not a pervert. And so he, on erections, and there was this wonderful four-dimensional moving picture footage of a penis erecting, his, by the way. And in that paper, he said, my next project will have to do with a scan of human genitals in heterosexual intercourse. I'm like, on the internet, sending him a note going, I'd really like to be there for this historic undertaking. And he wrote back surprisingly right away, and he said, dear Ms. Roach, I would be happy to, we would be happy to oblige, but we have been unable to find any volunteers for this project. If your organization can find a brave couple for intimate study, I would be happy to oblige. So, so my, my organization called its husband. I said, you know how you said you haven't been to London in 25 years? Well, we could go, and I'll pay for everything, and we'll go to the West End, and we'll go to the Tate Gallery, and we have to have sex in front of a guy in a white coat, and then we'll go to see Stonehenge anyway. So, and Ed is the kind of guy, when I started the book, he goes, oh, sex research, sign me up. You know, so he had it coming. Anyway, fast forward, and Ed is the kind of guy who can put it in the, he's like good at denial, packed it in the back of his head, did not think about it, had a great time for a few days, until the point where outside Dr. Deng's, and this is the London hospital, it's the radiation department, and we're sitting there, and like all of a sudden Dr. Deng is walking down the hall in the white coat, and Ed just goes like, oh my God, here he comes. Anyway, so it was, you know, people say, well, how were you able to do this? Really, it was less like sex than like one of those sort of weird things that you go to the hospital and they say to you, you know, well, now I'll be sticking my finger up your rear end. And you go like, okay, because it's the hospital and that kind of thing happens. So we just stand there, and he gave us the little johnnies to wear, the little horrible with the back open, the little, and then he goes, and Dr. Deng, if you're going to have sex in front of anybody, Dr. Deng is a really great choice because he's kind of humorless and really serious. And he looks at Ed and he hands him a brown envelope and he says, this is very erotic. He wants to help Ed. It's a copy of Maxim. also Viagra has been taken. So, anyway, so Then he kind of explains to us the position. We now you have to be in a very special, a certain position because ultrasound, you know, has to be on the, okay? So he's actually, we're like spoons and we're facing the wall and he's got the ultrasound thing here. And then Ed and him are actually having I'm taking notes the entire time. And Ed is they're having a conversation about their kids. I'm not kidding. It's serious. And at a certain point, I hear Ed saying, and your little one, how old is she now? And Dr. Deng replies, this is really true. He says, she's just two now. You can ejaculate if you like. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Roach. It's a hard act to follow. So she gave a great demonstration of staying under 5 minutes. That's one of the key rules. This is Karina, who's the marketing coordinator for First Person Arts, and she's also our timer for the evening. And she doesn't just do it by intuition. She actually has a real clock.
Don't text me during this, because I need this.
And I need to get to the real nuts and bolts here because this is a science, judging. It's, you know, it's intuitive, but it also involves a lot of actual repeatable things that we have to judge here. Okay, so each judge. Judges, are you? You're on the ball. You're right here. It's so nice that you're right here.
And the audience should listen, too, because you're judging with your audience scorecards.
That's true. Yes, there's a white paper in your program. Everybody take out their white paper, and maybe you got a tiny little pencil, like you're playing mini golf. Or maybe you just borrow a pencil from the person next to you. Great. So the white paper is for you and will be collected at the end when it's time to tabulate. Well, when it's time to put them all in a bucket, and later on they'll all be tabulated to figure out who the audience choice winner is for the evening. But that'll be get announced on Facebook and Twitter and stuff on Monday. So it's some delayed gratification to find out who the audience really wants. The judges tonight, their things will get revealed at the end, of course. So the way that you should all be judging this, here we go. Each judge and audience member will give all the storytellers 2 scores, one for the content of their story and one for the presentation. Each score is on a 10-point scale, 10 being the most fantastic. So content is a measure of how well the story is crafted. For instance, it has a beginning, middle, and end that are all absorbing and interesting. It has a plot that grabs the listener, drives to a conclusion with interesting twists and turns. It describes characters, situations, and places well. It offers unique observations or insights. Content. Was it great? And then the score for the presentation is a measure of how well the storyteller tells their story with an engaging or distinctive voice or style, brings the story to life, connects with and plays off the audience, or stays focused throughout. So for this one, if somebody gets up here and tells a great story, but it's actually about lima beans, then unless they do a little bit of work to tie it to experiments, you might want to take a point off. So if it strays from the topic, although I'm a big believer in tangential connections, so you know that's sort of up to
that's
you.
That's why you're not judging.
Good point. All right.
Zing.
Clear enough. Okay. So here I am telling you what I have to say here. We've done all of this stuff, and now I think it's time, right? Am I forgetting anything else?
I think you're
good.
Does
anyone else need a pencil?
You guys ready?
Dan Gashevsky.
For more stories?
Yep. Okay, so our first, we're going to draw them randomly in terms of order. And the first storyteller this evening is Catherine Leisner.
Team
Yay!
Boston.
Yeah, please, come on up. Catherine Leisner. And she's from Boston, everybody.
So, at every Leisner family reunion, Alicia and I stuck out from the rest of our extended farm family folk. We were the brainy cousins. Alicia was tall and pale and had big purple glasses, and I was short and stuttered and knew all my presidents. And we like to think of ourselves, however, as the Leisner literati, because we had read and discussed the Bobbsey twins to some length. So what we like to do for fun in our nerdy way was play Bobbsey twins around our grandparents' farm. And there was no intrigue on the farm. There were no cow nappings while I was there or, you know, barn break-ins. But we found a bunch of cat bones and brought them in and laid them out on our grandmother's kitchen table for forensic analysis. Well, our grandma walked in and she said, "Oh, no, you gotta get those out of there." Like, okay. So we were quickly learning that rural Wisconsin had very limited opportunities for intellectual pursuit. So we decided that we would create our own medium of inquiry. And we decided to create our own flagship publication, the Leisner News. Our idea was big, our readership small. We were going to be the first ones on the scene to cover all the latest in Leisner family goings-on. So we started working our beat by talking to the aunts and uncles, see if anyone had seen or heard anything, if they had any leads. And most of our exchanges went something like this. Aunt Carol, have you seen anything suspicious or stranger newsworthy? No, not that I can think of there. What do you want? Can you describe what you're looking for? We're getting nothing out of them. We tried to do some muckraking into the potato salad. Because what were those green flecks anyway? Nobody knew. Chives, turns out. Nothing there. So Alicia and I reconvened. We met. We knew we had to have an emergency editorial meeting. And we decided that we were going to go the William Randolph Hearst route with this, which is basically, if you can't get the news, you manufacture the news. So what we were going to do is we were going to stage and then report on our very own experiment. And our experiment was this. We were bound and determined to find out which Leisner cousin could go the longest without going to the bathroom. We started by both, you know, empirically emptying our bladders. And all afternoon, we went root beer for root beer, Kool-Aid for Kool-Aid, as our abdomens were swelling precariously. But, you know, Alicia and I were intellectuals, so we weren't too burdened by, you know, the demands of the body. So we continued playing with our cousins, and we just held it in the whole time and started getting really hard, and we're holding it in figuratively at first, and then literally with both hands. And then our playing grew lower and lower to the ground until all we could do was sit on the floor playing board games because we didn't have too many other options. This went on all day. Finally, nightfall comes. Both Alicia and I had still held out. We were snuggling into our Carmen Sandiego sleeping bags on the floor. And our mom, yep. And our moms came in to tell us goodnight. They asked, you know, "Have you girls brushed your teeth?" "Yeah." And then they asked, "Did you remember to use the bathroom?" I thought I would field this one. I said, "Well, we started a newspaper today, and the first piece of news that we're going to do is just find out who can go the longest without peeing. We haven't peed all day." And our mothers looked at us horrified. They didn't see a little Woodward and Bernstein there. They saw two hyper-pressurized bladders poised above the carpeting. They ordered us to the bathroom. "But we can't," we protested. We were too committed to the newspaper. Also, we couldn't stand up anymore. But the moms held their ground. They made us go. I was so mad as I scooted on my butt down the hallway to the bathroom. We'd been experimenting all day for nothing. They ruined it. They killed the story, and it turned out our fledgling newspaper. The Leisner News never made it to press. But they couldn't kill our academic spirit, because Alicia and I were the two cousins, the two Leisner cousins, to go to graduate school. Alicia became an epidemiologist, and specializing in rabies. And as part of her research, she had to monitor the bat population of Milwaukee, which involved going into attics with a flashlight. It was very Bobsy-esque. I was very proud of her. I went to Boston University for journalism school, and there they taught us you never, ever, ever fabricate or sensationalize the news. And I came to appreciate, then, our mother's wisdom, because by ending our bladder stunt, they had saved us from yellow journalism.
Come, Katie, come back. Katie, come back. For your prize. Come back for your... We spent lots of money on these dollar store prizes. There's like 12 of them up here, so that's $12.
It's my job to choose an appropriate gift for you, and I'm going to prepare you with goggles, should your bladder level ever rise. Yes.
Thank you.
Catherine Leisner. And I forgot to also say that there's one dingling of the bell at 4 minutes. Then there's another dingling of the bell at 5. So it's just a 4-minute warning. So don't start marking off points when you hear the
first
bell.
Don't stress out at the first bell. It's
so this is when you're tabulating for both presentation and content. Somewhere on the range from 0 to 10. Are the judges, is that enough time? Great. Let's hear it. We've got an 8-7, a 7-8, and a 7-7. This is content first and
presentation.
Yes, second. 8-7, 7-8, 7-7. Great. Now we're going to move on to our next. Should we clap? Sorry. Clapping again. More clapping. Lots and lots of clapping all through the night. We're going to draw our next randomly selected piece of paper with our next storyteller.
Bernardo.
Bernardo. Hey, that's not me. That's handwriting, buddy. we went over name pronunciation already. Bernardo Murillo.
You going to come up? Bernardo.
And Bernardo is, without a doubt, representing Philly.
Benito. That's my new stage name. So, wow, lots of people. Anyway, there, Dr. Jürgen Oswald Peterson had an epiphany while he was taking off his scrubs and he was looking at the stains of blood of his patient and his scrubs that he had just operated on. And he realized that this thing that he felt at the moment was nervousness, because as a brain surgeon, when he operated, he didn't know how it went. They had to wait for days until they could do some tests with their patients and ask them questions and figure out if they could move, if they could see, if they could understand, if they remember things. And he realized that if he could figure out a way to operate on a patient that was awake and aware at the moment, he would be able to get this information as he was performing the operation. And at the same moment of clarity, he realized everything that he needed for this. He needed a multidisciplinary team that required everybody from linguists so that they could understand what were the right questions to ask while you were performing these brain surgeries, so that you could tell if you were affecting different parts of the brain positively or negatively while he was operating. He needed an anesthesiologist that could control the levels of deep sleep or profundity of the sleep on the patient so that they could awake them in the middle of the surgery, ask a couple of questions, find out how things were going, bring him back down into deep sleep. So it was like an incredible, gigantic enterprise. And he also, before he was done taking all his scrubs, realized that this was a great opportunity to capture all this event unfolding, and that there should be video cameras rolling all the time so that they can document the development of this idea, so that students can look at how ideas come together, how interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary teams come together. And the idea of documenting everything on video was part of his epiphany. And that's where I came into the picture, because I used to work at a company that used to sell the computers that you use to cut the videos. And this was in the 90s when having a computer for editing video was not that easy to get. Nowadays, you can get that anywhere. And I used to install the computer and give a little bit of training to the people that bought them and say, this is how you turn it on, turn it off, and this is how you get the video in, and, you know, the sound and this and that. So I went to the institution where they were gathering. This was like 2 years after he had his epiphany. The whole funding was in place, and the scientists were all together, and they were ready to start this whole development, and the video cameras were rolling, and I arrived with the boxes, and we put together a computer. And, you know, it took a little bit of time, and then I said, you know, when you purchase one of these computers, you know, it comes with an hour or two of training. So if you guys want, I can show you how to use it. And they all looked at me like, well, Dr. Peterson here is a neuroscientist and is developing this great idea, which is going to change the way brain surgery unfolds. And Dr. Johnson here is an anesthesiologist, which is going to change the perception and understanding of depths of sleep and awareness while you're performing a surgery. And Dr. Kim here is a linguist and a neurologist and an anthropologist, which is going to figure out how to communicate and gather information from our patients while we are operating. So I think that we can figure it out. So I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds right to me. So I left. 3 or 4 weeks later, I get a phone call. And there's a major crisis. Every time, everything, they keep on bringing all this material into the computer, and they're cutting things, and everything's going really well, and all of a sudden, everything disappears. And they're like freaking out, and they're like losing focus, and the team, there's tension in between the team. So they call me back in, because I'm the tech guy with the computer. So I show up, and I say, okay, so I want to know what's happening when the stuff disappears. And they all look at me and say, look, well, it never happened to me, says the anesthesiologist. You know? And then the anthropologist said, well, you know, I'm pretty, you know, handy with computers, and it never happened to me. But so it was Dr. Peterson, the guy with the epiphany. And it's like, you have to understand that this guy is brilliant and he's a genius. And, you know, it's like, you know, you got to be gentle with the guy because, you know, the whole discovery and evolution of surgery is, you know, in stake. So he comes in and he says, well, I understand that you've been told, you know, I've been thinking about this for months, and it probably has something to do with the electromagnetic field and, like, the speed of the drive and the connection with the phone, and I don't know, I can't figure this thing out, and I can't think about it because I have to figure the surgery. And so I say, okay, show me what happens when the events unfold. And he says, well, I'm working on the computer, the phone rings, I answer, everything disappears. So it's probably the phone and the electromagnetic field, and I'm like, well, show me. And he's like, okay, I'm working on the computer, turns on the program, he's showing me his little sequence, nurses are running around, and then he says, the secretary is on cue, she phone rings, he picks up, he leans back, he crosses his leg, and everything disappears. And I saw what happened. So I was very proud of myself, and I was like, okay, this is going to be fun. So I go, okay, give me 1 second. So I move the computer 1 inch back, and I said, okay, try it now. And everybody's looking at me like, this guy's crazy. And he turns on the computer again, and he's like, okay, on cue, phone, 3, 2, 1. Phone rings, he picks up, crosses his leg, nothing disappears. And they're all looking at me like, wow, this is amazing. Like, and they're like, yeah. You know, like, like when I got there, there was like no space. There's not enough space in the room because there was too many egos, and now you could breathe and move and walk. And they are like, okay, what happened? Because we need to know. And I mean, when a scientist says they want to know, they really want to know. And what had happened was that, like, as Dr. Peterson would lean back to answer his phone and cross his leg, his shoe would brush on the on and off power button of the computer and it would turn it off. And that was it. And they were like, everybody was very happy about the results of the investigation. And Dr. Peterson was like bright red, like a tomato. And I just looked at him and I said, well, if it makes you feel any better, my father is a neurologist.
Okay. we have a debate here about which dollar store prize you get
for
that.
VHS tape or magnifying glass?
VHS tape, magnifying glass for the inspector.
VHS, he's a video.
True, you're
it will help
guy.
You with your career.
Thank you. Amazing. I keep forgetting the bucket. Okay, so this is also when I should have said that there's a group of people potentially watching us up there, not us so much, watching the storytellers, and this is a shout out to you folks who may not be in this room, but who are here via technology.
We're in simulcast? Is that what that means?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not
That's
really
cool.
clear. I was just told
That's a
by
big deal. That's in Tina Fey.
That the friendly man who introduced everything just mentioned it offhandedly that I should send a shout out to the people upstairs. I don't think.
Hi, people up there. Hello.
They're really it's not just in heaven or whatever. It's upstairs. I think there's TV projections for people who couldn't fit in the room.
Yeah.
So, judges, is that enough time? Great. We've got a content 8.5 and a presentation 8, a content 8, a presentation 8, a content 7, and a presentation 8. Great. Ooh. So, that goes for Bernardo. And now, I draw our next storyteller.
I thought you were getting all religious, and I was like, this is a science festival, Beth.
No, it's totally true. They're up there. I hear them. Okay. Jim Stahl, you're next. And this is Jim from Boston. A hand for Jim.
When I was 13, everybody was making bombs. The PLO, the IRA, the SDS, the SLA. In 1969, if you had initials, you had a bomb. I was a science-minded young kid. I made my own from an M80 firecracker and a scale model of the Saturn V rocket. That's the one that took the Apollo 11 astronauts to the moon. Four M80s have the same explosive kick as a stick of dynamite. So I had, in effect, scotch taped, a quarter stick of dynamite to the insides of a toy. I lit the fuse, and I waited to see what would happen next. What I saw in my hand looked nothing like what I had seen on TV. What I saw looked and sounded like confetti being blown through a straw. Bang! Suddenly, I am deaf in both ears, I am blind in this eye, and almost blind in this. Now, had both eyes been hit, my life would have changed in that moment, absolutely. But as it turns out, what I've seen with one eye since age 13 are pretty much the same things you've seen with two. So an artificial eye was made for me, but it didn't exactly fit. It looked in directions I didn't ask it to look. And if I moved my head too fast this way or that, it wanted to fall out. Because in order to stay in place, it needed suction. Well, 4 days after getting my new eye, in Mrs. Garcia's Spanish class, eighth grade, it lost its suction. There was a noise at the back of the room, and I spun my head too fast, and suddenly my eye is bouncing on the desk. But I need to tell you that artificial eyes are not round like a ball. In fact, they're shaped like small pancakes. And they're concave like a contact lens, but they bounce. They bounce! So mine hit the desk, and it leapt into the air and did a kind of shimmy at the top of its arc right next to Linda Schwartz. Linda's hair was soft and blonde and smelled like cookies. And all I wanted in the eighth grade was to touch it. And when I began my dive to get the eye back, her hair was still before me, but every other head in class spun in my direction. Now, maybe in that split second before my dive to get it back, my peers mistook what they saw in flight for something else. Maybe in spite of my eyes' beautiful blue hand-painted iris, they thought they saw a ball bouncing, or maybe an eraser, or maybe a retainer, because retainers were always falling out of mouths in the eighth grade. So somewhere after the second but into the third bounce on the floor, I, in my Boston Red Sox jersey, am sliding up the aisle, and the bastard eye is in my palm, out of sight. In Fenway Park, Carl Yastrzemski used to make catches like that, but his diving snags, yards before the green monster, were always followed by the raising of the glove to display the orb like a prize. So the umps and the fans would know the truth of the catch. The truth in my hand could not be shown. Not even for its beautiful blue hand-painted iris. Thank you.
Great. So I really like getting to think about what everybody's story is and where it's going to go. When it started, I thought he was talking about bongs, and 13 seemed a little early to start building your own. Probably 17 was more my time. But then also, I also remember briefly, and this is the problem why I don't participate in story slams in general, is because I can't actually remember. Part of the rules is that the story needs to be true. And there's this story that I always tell about this girl I went to camp with who had a glass eye, and before we went swimming, she would take it out and put it in her shoe, and then after we went swimming, she would put it in her mouth and then suck off any dirt that was on it and then put it back in her eye. But then I've told that story to people, and they're like, that's not how that works. You can't just pop it in and out like a retainer. So I may need to do some fact-checking with you afterwards. And in the meantime, though, I think the judges have tabulated. We've got a content 10, a presentation 9, content 9, presentation 10, content 9, and presentation 10. All right, Jim. Nice work. And now I am going to call up to the mic from Boston as well, Nora Dooley. Nora. Come on up.
So I'm involved in a DNA experiment. It's a very long-range research project. And I think that human subject research is sort of one of the most evil things that's happened in society today. I'm talking about non-consensual, uninformed human subject research. And it's really dismaying to me to know that I am in just such a project. Because my husband and I are testing the hypothesis that with our DNA, we could produce happy, healthy human beings. And we've been doing this project now for 28 years. And folded into that project, though, was my desire, and is still a desire, to practice medicine. Although I am a practicing artist and a storyteller, I really didn't have the chops for science. But when we had these four children that we were trying to see if we could raise them to be happy and healthy, it turned out that they had recurrent ear infections, every single one of them, constantly. So my first search was for a pediatrician who would let me co-prescribe, you know, so we can up the antibiotics and up the antibiotics, because what I was really also looking for was a full night's sleep. So when I ran out of antibiotics to up to, like, well, cefalexin, this core, whatever, you know, this is a four, blah, blah, I moved to natural medicine. Now, in natural medicine, I turned from being a sociopath and doing human subject research into a homeopath. And I started to study homeopathy. Now, homeopathy is an interesting thing. You know, what they do is they take all these different substances and they shake them in water, and then they pour that water on little tiny tablets of sugar. And actually, Boricke and Taffel is one of the first homeopathic pharmacies right here in Philadelphia. So I figured that the risk-benefit was pretty good, because there was really very little risk to give this to your children. But the benefits, I kept on waiting for the benefits. I'm waiting for the benefits. Give me some benefits. I want a full night's sleep. Well, I was not getting a full night's sleep. But I did have one major success with this method. And that was, there's one remedy called Arnica Montana. And it is very good for bruises. And I started prescribing this. Now, I had a bunch of friends with children the same age as our four children. We hung out together. And frequently, someone would fall down, and I would say, oh, you need Arnica. And I would give them Arnica. And there was this one time that was really amazing, because everyone was in the kitchen, and this girl came in, and she had a lump. She had fallen down our stairs, and she had a lump that was growing out of the forehead that was like a golf ball of blue, throbbing hematoma. And I said, oh, Arnica Montana. I gave some to her. And as she sat and her mother comforted her, this thing went down. It disappeared. I mean, I just gave her another dose and another dose, and it disappeared. Well, it shouldn't have surprised me then when I started to get emergency calls, but this was the best one. As you know, experiments require guinea pigs, so not just children, but guinea pigs are important. And I got a chance. My friend Roberta called me up. Apparently, her son had been doing his own experiments with gravity from the top of a bunk bed and had dropped their guinea pig from there. The guinea pig was now completely paralyzed from the waist down. If you can say a guinea pig has a waist. Anyway, so she called me up and she said, Nora, we've already been to Angel Memorial, and they say that it's a dead guinea pig. It can't eliminate. It'll just, you have to help us. Don't you have a remedy for it? Guinea pig. I can do this experiment. So the problem with homeopathy, you need to know, though, is that you have to do this really arcane kind of triages, because they have developed all their terminology from the 19th century. So the questions are things like, is the subject afraid of riding in open carriages? You can imagine. This is difficult to ascertain in your children, but with guinea pigs, it's really hard. So I read through and I read through and I read through, and it's, you know, it's a spinal trauma injury. It's hypericum perforatum. So I prescribe hypericum perforatum. But you have to come and bring it. Okay, I'll bring it. Roberta, I'm bringing it. I bring it. My kids are going out to the park. We'll talk to you later. I'll bring it. You know, I'm thinking, well, whatever. Yeah, so I bring it. I drop it off. And we go out to the park. And no one was more surprised than I when I came home. And there was a message on our machine. Apparently, after four doses of hypericum perforatum, this guinea pig had jumped off the lap, scampered down the leg, and right into its cage, its hind legs working perfectly well, and it hid underneath the ripped newspaper. So when I used guinea pigs, I had great results. But on human beings, the findings are still out. Thank you.
Great, your million-dollar prize. I think this is the one for you.
Okay.
The pure fragrance body oil of Michael Jordan. yeah. It's not quite homeopathy, but, you know, it's in a vial. Great. So I also want to tell you about how tonight, after this thing ends, if you're feeling as though, oftentimes you know how the Story Slam is at Latage, and you can sip a beer as you hear people's stories. And this year, this evening, we've sort of striated your experience or whatever, and you're going to have this kind of sitting in the audience experience. And then if you want to go to the after party and drink your beer, then you can combine them in the overall picture of your night. And that after party is at the Kite and Key, which, does anyone know where that is? Where is it? Great, it's right behind here, apparently. 19th and Kylo Hill. Who knew that it was right there? 19... 1836, Callow Hill. Thank you. The audience is full of wisdom. All right, now we're moving on to judges. We've got content 8, presentation 7, content 7, presentation 8, content 6, presentation 7. Okay. And for Nora. All right. From Philly, we've got Michael Minard. Minard. How do you say your last name?
Minard.
Michael Minard.
Make some noise, Philadelphia!
Okay, so I'm 22 years old. I'm at a Penn State graduation party. My girlfriend, Rock On Nittany Lions. And I spot from across the crowd this broad-shouldered bully named Kevin rushing towards me. And the only thing that's different this time is he does not have a chainsaw in his hand. But all I can think to myself is, I have the shittiest karma. Now, the reason I said that is because I grew up Buddhist, and I was always called a faggot because I refused to resort to violence. You see, Buddhism is very strict about that. I mean, we make the Quakers look like bare-knuckled brawlers. So, you know, I had a legitimate concern, and I decided to study human behavior when I went to college. The only problem is that in the Buddhist handbook, there's nothing against smoking pot excessively and skipping class in high school. So I had to go through Mon Alto, a satellite campus, which was kind of in the Pennsylvania sticks. And, you know, even though I graduated high school, it seemed that the violence continued to follow me. So I arrived in Mon Alto. Mon Alto was known not only as a gateway school up to main campus, but it was also known as a forestry school. And for 2 years, you could sit there and learn the meticulous science of cutting down trees, wielding chainsaws, and drinking ungodly amounts of bourbon. Remember that? So Kevin was the first person to spot this low-hanging fruit bully bait, who was I, as I walked onto campus. And he harassed me endlessly through school. Hey, Minard, go ahead, hit me. I mean, this was over the squeal of his chainsaw and his Pittsburghian lilt. Go ahead, hit me. What's the problem? What are you, a faggot? What are you, a faggot? You know what we do to faggots around here? We string them up like Matthew Shepard. Wow. Yeah. So after a few semesters of that, I was given the reprieve, and I went up to main campus to study human behavior and do scientific research. Now, the thing about scientific research in human behavior is that it's all about deception. Experimental designs are about deception. It's kind of like the head fake of the scientific world, right? A subject will go in, they'll be told they'll be measured for one thing, and in fact, they're being measured for another. And it was no different in my last year of school when I played gay 250 times. I was gay for my last year of college, 250 times, because I was what was known as a confederate. I was an actor in scientific research. And what the professor was trying to do is pick apart whether or not someone became uncomfortable enough to measure in the results of a test when the person in the room that was present said they were either gay or straight. So people would come in. I would sit down next to them. We'd start a test. We'd be filling out personal information. I'd walk over to the proctor. I'm gay. My boyfriend lives in Pittsburgh. Okay, no problem. Then I'd sit back down, and we'd continue the test. And supposedly, they were able to measure results, you know, some variations and whatnot. So one day, I walk into the room, and there's Kevin, pursuing extra credit for Psych 101, I'm sure, and he's meticulously sharpening his pencil to this dagger point, and he looks up at me with a devilish grin and mouths, Bernard. So I sit down next to him, we start taking the test, and when the point comes that I've got to stand up and I've got to proclaim my sexuality or my sexual orientation, I get up, I walk over to the proctor, and I say, I'm gay, and my boyfriend lives in Pittsburgh. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I said I'm gay, and my boyfriend lives in Pittsburgh. I heard the pencil drop behind me, and all I can imagine, I'm just waiting for the dagger point to strike me in the flesh, right behind my shoulder blade, and I'm just going to pass out. But nothing happened. I turned around. Kevin didn't even look up. I sat back down. And actually, he finished his test, turned it in, and walked out. Now, Months later, we're at this party. He's charging across the crowd. I'm bending my knees. I'm raising my hands to protect my face and bracing for the impact. And he runs over and he stops. Menard! And he mimics my, "What are you doing?" And he gives me this big, manly bear hug. "Oh, my God, I can't believe this. You know, I thought I was all alone in Mont Alto. I was hiding. Remember, Tom, I had such a crush on him. And, you know, it wasn't until the study that we saw each other. I could." And he went on and on and on and on. And then all of a sudden, he bellowed to the heavens, "I'm from Pittsburgh, and I'm gay!" And the entire crowd had gone completely quiet. And he didn't notice one bit of this. I've got my girlfriend. Her claws are in my back. And he reaches over, sotto voce, "Oh, by the way, you still dating that guy in Pittsburgh?"
I was told that this is a sign to you. As a continuation of your experiment.
I didn't get
a pink tiara.
Come and have a beer with us. I'll wear it.
Great. Okay, judges. Ooh, you guys are quick. I like it. Content 9, presentation 9. Look at that. Even-keeled jury. Okay, so here we go. From Philly, we have Michael McCary. Michael McCary, here you go. Nice to have you.
Sure. Hi. I'm tall. Ready to roll? Mm-hmm. All right. So essentially, my childhood can be defined by four major characters. We have my father figure, pretty most of you got them. My mother, who scares me. My little brother, and the wooden spoon that my mother wielded every time that I did something wrong. She was not a Buddhist. God. All right, and essentially, my entire adolescent years were a big, long experiment seeing how quickly I could make her rush and get that wooden spoon and smack me with it, okay? We did a biological experiment. See, I had thrown a boomerang up into the top of a tree in the backyard, and my mother and father said, "Do not climb the tree. Do not climb the tree." But I had a little brother. He was the Chucky to my Tommy Pickles. And I was like, "Nathaniel." He's 3.5 years younger than me. At that time, he was just old enough that, like, he could cognitively take some responsibility for things, but just small enough that I could force him physically into doing them. And so, like, I send him up the tree. And this is right after school. My mom's making dinner in the kitchen. And the little bastard loses his grip and falls, hits a branch, lands on the ground, and shatters his wrist. His arm is in permanent RuPaul mode, okay? And, like, he's losing it. He's not crying, but he's holding it together. And I'm like, "Nathaniel, listen to me. We got to go out into the street, and you got to act like you fell down. You were not in that tree." And he looks at me, and he's like, "All right." And like, I know he cannot withstand the law and order interrogation that is going to go on in this kitchen when we get inside, okay? I know he's going to break down. I march him out into the street. I strategically place some leaves, and I go, 1, 2, 3, fall. And I go, "Mom!" We go to the emergency room, okay? She's got suspicions. He's got grass stains on him and stuff. She comes out of that emergency room, and the doctor says, "Michael, let me see you," and takes me to another exam room, and just smacks me with the spoon. Like, "What? You got nothing, woman. What? What?" And she hits me again. And I'm like, "What? We didn't do anything. He fell in the street. I saved him." Like, and she goes, "Do you have anything else you want to tell me?" And I was like, "No, ma'am. No way, no how." Got away with it. Never found out. Nathaniel never broke. So we continued experimenting later on in life. We became chemists, okay? I lit M80s, oddly enough, in the upstairs bathroom, and panicked as the fuses were going down and handed them to Nate, who panicked and threw them in the toilet and hit the flush button. And then we waited like we were the fat kid who just turned the corner in a horror movie and that, like, eerie silence, you know, before something bad happens. And then boom, Michael! And then the silence again. And then, like, Aunt Jemima Cross with a buffalo. She came running up the stairs. And I'm standing there at the top going, she goes, he didn't do that, and smacked me twice as I ran across the room. They like did it like collar grab smack. And then hits my little brother once, because he did comply at some point. And then comes back to me and goes, you got anything else you want to tell me? I was like, no, I'm done, thank you. Then there's this other time where I decided to test the physics of how badly I could piss her off. Nathaniel's in the driveway, and he's going down the driveway in his big wheel, and he's impacting the garage door. And I go, you know what? With a little bit more velocity and force, maybe a harder object, we could do some real damage here. So I got that red wheelbarrow that everybody used to carry flowers in, and I put a helmet on him, and I duct taped the little bastard to it. And I took him up to the top of the driveway, and I shoved him as hard as I could. Except, like, the wheels for that thing aren't meant for, like, a 50-pound object to be going 70 miles an hour towards a garage door. And it kind of flipped on its side and smashed into the garage, ripped right through the wood, and he drilled the back bumper of my father's Chevrolet. That woman came outside, and she must be a genius, because he's half sticking out of the garage, okay? She walks into the garage, and his head with the helmet is, like, pointed out, and just spanked him 3 or 4 times while he's stuck there. She walks back out of the garage and looks me in the eye and goes, look what you just did to your little brother. I am amazed. This wooden spoon becomes a mythical object at some point, okay? And she decides to stop using it when I acquire man size when I'm like 14 and just puts it on the wall, okay? Mike, late for school? I was like, yeah. Point at the spoon. I'd be like, Mike, you told teacher what? Point at the spoon. Like, and I'm scared of the spoon. I get chills. I get shakes. Okay? And it lasts to this day. A couple weeks ago, I did what I always do, and I parked where I shouldn't have in Philadelphia, and those Nazis ticketed me like 4 times in the same spot. Okay? I didn't pay them because I was taking a political stance, and they got mailed to my parents' address. She calls me, and she's like, Michael, you're 27. When are you going to understand where and when you can't park? I'm like, Mom, I don't know. Blah, blah, blah. And she yells at me, and I finally just hang up on her. 30 seconds later, I get a text message. It's the spoon. And it just says under it, you got anything else you want to tell me?
This is a weapon.
Man, we don't have a spoon.
We don't have any good weapons.
We have an I love you mug.
Oh, man. It's hard. I'm a younger sister, so I have to say I feel a little vengeful, but I'm reaching deep to give you the heart mug and move past all the times when my brother wanted to slingshot me up into on the trampoline. You know how if you get the right thing going, you can fire the other person off, and sometimes when they land, they're not on the trampoline anymore. And sometimes they land on a rock and tear their ACL, which is a lot for a little kid to know that that stands for anterior cruciate ligament. You guys ready? We've got a content 8, a presentation 8, a content 7, a presentation 8, a content 9, and a presentation 9.
Ooh. Oh, interesting.
Whoa. Is it so you're booing the judges because you disagree?
Yeah. That's okay.
Wow.
They can do
See,
that.
I feel like, you know, it's all's fair in love and war and story slam. You know, people have different standards. We've got some different people who think maybe that, you know, the best story hasn't even been told yet. So they're holding out on tens and things. You never
That's
know.
So nice.
We have so much to hear from still. From Team Philly, we've got Marla Burkholder. Marla, come on up. Come on down.
Thanks. I grew up in a Mennonite family. And if you're not familiar with Mennonites, picture an Amish family that drives a car. If you're not familiar with Amish people, picture Little House on the Prairie people living today. So it's based in a group of people living simply and peaceably separate from the consumerism and materialism of the rest of the world. And this was sometimes hard for a young girl growing up in the material girl 80s, especially in moments like when a glamour photo shop moved into our small town. Glamour photo shops were these amazing inventions in the 1980s where you would go and they would doll you up with like soap opera makeup and poof your hair out and then pose you in front of neon backgrounds like real models and take your picture. And I really, really wanted to do this. And my no-nonsense Mennonite parents were having none of that. So I decided to recreate my own glamour photo session. I recruited my younger tomboy sister to be the model, and I put her in my mother's Sunday clothes and smeared her with whatever makeup I could find and posed her seductively on the sofa while I experimented with double exposing some film so that I could get kind of a fashion layout montage of beauty. It so happened that my great-grandmother died that same week, and my great-grandmother was a plain Mennonite woman. Her whole life she wore long dresses and a head covering, and Mennonites are thrifty, so to save money, my family drove her coffin to her burial. I'm not even sure that's legal, but 8 hours in the van with my great-grandmother's coffin, and we got there and we rearranged her from all the jostling, and then we got ready to take pictures. I don't know if other families do this, but my family takes pictures like next to the coffin. I think it's a little disturbing because you'll be looking through a photo album and you'll be like, first day of school, birthday parties, dead Aunt Gladys. But we do this, so we took pictures of my great grandmother, and as you can guess, my glamour photo session and my pictures of my grandmother's funeral got double exposed together. It's something that could happen back when there was real film. And this miracle picture came out of my younger sister dressed like a prostitute floating out of my great-grandmother's coffin. After the initial shock of that wore off, my family eventually saw this as a kind of amazing piece of art, and it's become a sort of funny family heirloom. And especially for me, I as I've gotten older, have stopped running so much from that past and have embraced some of that simplicity that I come from. Maybe not in the way I dress, but maybe in the way that I see the world and the way that I think. And I see that picture, and it reminds me of that experiment. And I think, yeah, I can try and dress up my past in all the whore makeup I want. But in the end, there's a little plain grandma who's pulling me back to who I really am.
I realize we have more prizes than there are people, so you get both fuzzy dice and a camera.
Awesome!
For your next shoot. Okay, so this doesn't leave a lot of suspense about who's last, but before we get on to that, we've got a 7 for content, a 9 for presentation. I'm reversing the order. I'm keeping things mixed up here.
Sexy.
A 9 for content, an 8 for presentation, and an 8.5 for content, and a 9 for presentation. Great job, Marla. And last but not least, or however you're supposed to say it, from Boston, we've got Ben Cunningham. Ben, come on up. Welcome.
Back in the 80s, my aunt and uncle lived in Columbia, South Carolina, and they owned one of those old color television sets, the kind that took about 3 people to move one into a living room because they're about the size of a piece of furniture. Now, these televisions had a nice hardwood, smooth finish on the outside, kind of like that podium right there. And these televisions also gave off low levels of radiation that, for the most part, was harmless. So from 9 to 5, all I did was watch TV while my aunt and uncle were at work. And the thing is, back in the 80s, you did not have many stations to choose from. You probably had 7 or 8. And in Columbia, South Carolina in the 80s, you didn't have a lot of variety in programs. You had televangelist, 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 pro wrestling, and B-movies. So I watched a lot of B-movies. And what I learned from these B-movies is that every monster, every mutant, every giant had one thing in common. It was radiation from the atomic bomb. Just like the radiation in that television. And I ran my hand across the screen and I felt that radioactive glow. The static electricity tingling on my palm. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could run my entire body across that screen? I could become a giant. I could become the colossal man. But the television was too small, and I was already too big. And that's when I looked at my aunt's goldfish tank. And I looked at the TV, and a light bulb went off in my head. Bling! Science experiment! I was going to run goldfish across the screen, and using the electromagnetic current from the TV and the radiation, I was going to cause their genes to mutate, and for the goldfish to just expand in size 100 times their normal size to the point that I would create giant mutant goldfish and solve world hunger. So I scooped the first goldfish out of the tank and I brought it to the screen. And there was a televangelist and he was screaming hellfire and brimstone and he was banging on his Bible, screaming about the end was coming near. And when I put that goldfish to the tank and to the screen and my hand touched the screen, it was like science and religion meeting for the very first time. And I dropped the goldfish back in the tank. And the goldfish went belly up. So I took the second goldfish and I changed the channel and there was Hulk Hogan and he had a wrestler's life in his hand just like I had the goldfish in his hand in my hand and they were stamping and stomping on the ground and I took the goldfish and I ran him the other way across the screen to reverse the current and I went whoosh and I dropped the goldfish back in the tank and that specimen just went belly up. Now I couldn't figure out all my specimens were dying. And I shut the TV off, and I let it juice back up, and I tried to figure out what was going on, and I turned the TV back on, and I grabbed the third goldfish, and I took it out, and there was Godzilla and some monster, and they were just going, and I took the goldfish, and I ran it round the screen, and I dropped that goldfish back in the tank, and that one just simply went, and by the end of the day, all the goldfish were floating at the top of the tank. And the televangelist was still going on, screaming hellfire and brimstone and banging on his Bible. But the volume was down, and it was like some surreal message from Revelations about the apocalypse that was soon to come. And it did. My aunt and uncle came through the door, and it was quite clear that my science experiment had failed. I had set out to solve world hunger, and instead, I was sent to bed without dinner.
I think you get the reptile and insects, in case you need new specimens. Maybe you need to play this Barbie guitar for them.
Yeah,
and see what happens. Yeah.
Vibes.
Yeah. Good work, Ben. Great. Okay. We've got a content 9 and a presentation 9, a content 9 and a presentation 9, and a content 8.5 and a presentation 9. Woo! Man. I want to thank all of the storytellers and all of the judges. You guys were all great. Personally, I think that judges should start at zero and then build up because you really get locked in the upper register once you start. So great. But it's too late to say that now. And maybe that just speaks to the fact that everyone ruled it. So that's great, too. We are now, what I'm going to tell you, is that we're going to collect the white scorecards that you guys have hopefully written all of your scores down on. And there's people walking around. You'll see them. You can pass your white scorecard to the end of the row if you're sitting here in the middle. That would streamline events.
And we're going to pick one of the scorecards tonight, and you'll win two free tickets to a future Story Slam. So
yeah, so that's motivation to fill it out right now.
But we need your name on there. That's the only rule.
Yeah, you need to put your name on it so they know who to give the two free tickets to. And then also, you see a yellow form in your program? Do you see this yellow form? This yellow form is from the Science Festival that... Woo-hoo-hoo! And this yellow form is trying to figure out who's coming to events at the Science Festival and why. And since this Story Slam is part of both the Science Festival and the Philadelphia Book Festival, they are trying to figure out who's who because of what. So be a guinea pig and contribute to their experiment in collecting research. Now, Karina is madly tabulating the judges' scores so that we can tell you who the winning city is and who the winning storyteller is. And then this weekend they'll tabulate who's the audience favorite. No one's even listening. They're all just a flurry with activity. Go, do your thing. I have nothing to say. Really, there isn't much else to say other than all this stuff. Slam Nation. I want to talk more about Slam Nation for any of the outliers who are listening. Slam Nation is this thing that I'm flipping to. Oh, it's the PIFA event. And it's September 26th.
You should come to it. You're going to get $10 off. It's going to be fun. April 26th, part of PIFA. We have award-winning storytellers coming from all across the country to the Kimmel Center. A couple of them are from MassMouth, so we'll have some more Boston representation. You get $10 off if you use your code, so you should totally come on out.
Great. So when you have that yellow piece of paper, you should give that to people who are standing around with, like, I love science buttons. There's one waving at the door. There's a fine fellow over there in a green shirt collecting them. So if you fill it out and you can pass it to someone who looks ready to take it, I would give it to them.
Has everyone turned in their audience scorecards so we can pick a raffle winner? Everyone turned it in? Okay, we're going to pick a name. Don't come up here right now, but come up after we're done, and we will give you your two free Story Slam tickets. Going once, going twice. Okay, we're back to the raffle winner, and then we will announce the winners of tonight's slam. Beth, you're going to... So exciting. Who's it going to be? Okay. Who is it? Is there a name? No name. You don't win anything. You lose. Try again. Pick again. What does going once, going twice mean? I thought it meant something else. Okay. Pick one.
Yes. Ken Sutherland.
Ken Sutherland. Yay. Come up here after the slam and you'll get two free tickets. And without further ado, we have a little bit of an, I don't know if it's called an upset. I don't know what the rules are, but we have a winning storyteller from one city and a winning team that is not that city. Would you like to announce?
Oh, I can't wait. All right, the winning storyteller is none other than Jim Stahl. Stand up, Jim. Stand up. Make yourself known. Yay. And look, you get a rocket set as well, a color your own rocket set. So much great stuff.
Go Boston!
And so that means that Philly wins the city. Woo! Thanks, everybody, for coming. Come join us at the after party at the Kite and Key. And come to other events at the Book Festival and at the Science Festival.
Thank you, judges.
Bye-bye.
Got to trim this thing down.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.